This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
Daniel Koshland's early interest in science, spurred by Sinclair Lewis's novel Aerosmith, led to a chemistry degree from Berkeley, a position on the Manhattan Project, and a career that transformed biochemistry. Koshland's research changed the understanding of enzymes through the induced fit theory, which posits that enzymes change shape as they react with other molecules. Also adept at administration, Koshland reorganized the biology program at the University of California at Berkeley in the late 1970s and served from 1985 to 1995 as the editor-in-chief of Science magazine. He established the Academy's Marion Koshland Science Museum in honor of his wife, a noted immunologist. Daniel Koshland was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1966. He died on July 23, 2007.
You have a long and illustrious career in science. What got you interested in science in the first place?
It's really so corny, I don't want to tell you. But when I was in the eighth grade, I was a big reader. And among things I read was Microbe Hunters. And shortly after that, I read Aerosmith. And the combination of it, I just loved the idea of science. And, you know, what I'm saying is I now recommend this to all sorts of, you know, my grandchildren and other people who are starting. But in interviewing a lot of students, a number of them had the same experience. But those are two great books, and I think those really taught me a lot about the fun of science and what it meant to go into them. So those were great books for me. Nobody in my family had ever gone into science, so it was really something very new. And then I think a big factor was I liked science in school. You know, I was good at math, and I did things like that. So I think in choosing careers, you sort of get into it step by step, which is what I did. So I can't really say absolutely I knew at that moment I was going to be a scientist, because I think if subsequent years I hadn't been good at it, I probably would have quit. But on the other hand, I think that's when I decided to be a scientist.
I noticed in things you've written in the past that an interest in mathematics or an aptitude for mathematics seems to be one of the selection factors for who goes into science,
right?
In fact,
I think because mathematics, I remember one of the criticisms I ran into when I was older of people talking about, you know, they don't make mathematics interesting enough for kids. They should relate it to the national budget or the problems of the population or something like that. And when I was doing math, I just loved problems like a boat was drifting downstream at 5 miles an hour and the stream was going 3 miles an hour. How fast was the boat going, you know? I mean, a problem that had no relation to the national budget. I couldn't care less about the national budget. I mean, I just love puzzles. And I remember that mathematics, I'd really loved doing that. And I think that most of the scientists I know liked mathematics at that age. Later on, you sort of had to have a special quirk, you know, to be interested in math when you were a biologist and so forth. But at early age, I think if you're not good at math, it's probably you shouldn't get into science.
You said there were no members of your family who were in the sciences, but were there members of your family who were very interested in problem solving and things like this, or even mathematics?
I never grilled them. That's really interesting. But I do have two members of my family who became scientists, and they are good at problem solving, and they seem to be interested in them, but I never really asked them very specifically. They were never in a position to be grilled by people like you.
Or you at that point.
Yes, correct. Right.
So you just precociously went towards science.
Well, I got, you know, you asked me when I started, and so I think that's when I began. And then I majored in, you know, I didn't major in science because you don't do that, but I majored in college prep, and you had to take so many chemistry courses and physics and things like that. So when I got to Cal, which is where I went as an undergraduate, then I majored in chemistry because I was really interested in biology, but everybody told me that time, remember, I was a long time ago. I'm very old. So the dinosaurs were roaming the earth when I went to college. But anyway, everybody told me that biochemistry was at a too early stage and it wasn't really taught very well. So I should major in chemistry and then switch to biology when I became a graduate student. That's what I did.
Was there a biochemistry department even?
Yes, there was, and I took the courses, but it was almost all memory, and it would have scared me right out of it. So I got really good advice. I really like chemistry, but like many chemistry departments, they were very hostile to biology. They considered it not a science. You know, the way a lot of scientists look at social science nowadays. You know, it's not very quantitative. It's not very real science.
You're saying this of biology, right?
Yeah, that's a lot of the chemists felt that way about biology.
Because it was observational, more or less, at that point?
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm.
What did your father do and your mother, and how did their lives affect your life, and how did they take...
Well, I really had wonderful parents, and I criticized them later on because I said we kids didn't understand our generation. All my generation was rebelling and so forth, and we really loved our parents and got along very well with them, so it was really bad training for the modern world. But anyway, and they were very nice about it. My father was in business, and my mother never went to college. She got married at 18, which was sort of the style of women at that time, and so she never went to college, which she regretted, and she took correspondence courses later on. But they both were very nice about it, and I remember years later, I sort of worried. I said to my father, did you really want me to go into the business? Because he never did any pressure, and they were all very enthusiastic about my going into science. And he said no, he was delighted with that. So that was it. So my parents were really very good, and I think we did the same thing with our children.
What business was he in?
He was in Levi Strauss & Company, which is a manufacturer of clothing. So it was a big business, and it was... My cousins went into it, and I didn't, because I was doing science. You know, that was one of those things.
Sounds like almost an idyllic childhood you had.
I did, yeah. So I can't complain. The reason I've gone astray is not due to my parents. I was due to my own machinations.
Did you have any early role models besides the books that you mentioned, the Microbe Hunters, the
authors? No, I didn't really have any people. I did meet... just sort of partly accidentally and partly, I think, was professors of the university who were in science because my parents knew them. But not, you know, nobody was specifically was said, you know, you ought to follow in his footsteps or things like that. Because I really read mainly books. I really read a little bit. But I really wanted to be either the Three Musketeers or a motorman or a airplane pilot. You know, those were really my ambitions, but
up changed. Until
then I found out I wasn't very good at some of them, but nevertheless.
But you gave them a try?
Well, I was an athlete in elementary school. I was a pitcher on the elementary school team, so I was pretty much of a big shot, you know, and I liked that, and I concealed the fact that I was very good at grades. You know, you're sort of ashamed of getting good grades and elementary school and high school. So I was proud of my athletic progress. And then, you know, when you go to high school, it's more competitive. And I realized I was probably a mediocre athlete, you know. So, and I was good at science and a mediocre athlete, so I drifted more and more into science. And part of the problem with athletics was I was a pitcher on this team, and the catcher, who's really much more intelligent than I, would say to me, you know, we got to go home and practice, and you got to pitch, you know, for hours every day. And I was just bored with it, and so I didn't want to do that. And he was right, of course, because athletics, like anything else, you got to really spend a lot of time at it. So my interest sort of shifted, and I think I was not as good. I was on the high school baseball team, but other pitchers were better than I was.
So boredom was sort of a motivator or a demotivator, in a sense.
Correct.
Get you away from that. This being ashamed of good grades, that's something that you have carried into not your own shame, but this is a topic that a lot of kids are, I think, ashamed of their academic achievements and don't follow their intellectual side, and that might select them out for scientific careers later on.
I think I may have said that a time, but I mean, it is true, and I think it's probably less true of this generation. But on the other hand, you know, in high school and grammar school, athletics are really the big thing. The big shots on campus are the football star, the track star, and so forth. And I was, you know, what was called four eyes, you know. I had glasses. I was really, fortunately, I was good enough, so I was on the baseball team, that I always concealed the fact that I was on the Honor Society. That was really not something you really mentioned very much. And if one of these people heard about it, that meant you automatically was a bad athlete and they'd put you on the second team or something like that. So I think that's less true in schools today than it was. I think there's much more understanding of kids about careers and things like that. So I don't feel that was a big hindrance to my education. I think it did influence how I emphasize things.
I want to talk a bit about your undergraduate focus when you went to college. How did you make that jump, that decision to go into science from the point you got out of high school?
I mean, well, in high school, for college entrance, you got to take English and science. But I'd taken physics and chemistry. You didn't take biology in those days. I mean, biology was the third science, and I just never got around to that. But then I majored in chemistry when I went to Cal. But I was really interested in going to biology, as I said. And so I majored in, and I really loved it. So I really enjoyed chemistry thoroughly. But I did want to take some courses in biology, and the instructor in chemistry at that time, his name I still remember, T.D. Stewart, was a person who really believed biology was a waste of time. You know, it wasn't scientifically demanding and things like that. And I had a terrible time getting my study list signed because I'd put biology and he'd cross it out and say advanced organic chemistry. And I said, I don't want to take advanced organic chemistry, I want to take biology. And I was getting very good grades. So if we protested it and went to the chairman of the department, they decided in my favor. And so I always won, but it was a big fight I had all the time. So that was the attitude of the chemistry department.
Do you think if they hadn't had that attitude that your entire career would have come out differently?
No. I think, it's one of those things that was a little bit of annoyance when I had to do it. But I was never really hindered from doing what I wanted to do.
You were at University of California at Berkeley for your undergraduate.
That's
a family thing, isn't it?
Well, it was sort of, there was a family tradition because my great uncle Monty was on the 1888 rugby team of the University of California. And I was, no member of the family has ever gotten to such a high status as that. So anyway, he did it, and I remember being told to me that great uncle Monty made the rugby team. So there was a long way. But in fact, I really seriously considered going to Harvard, but my mother got multiple sclerosis. So she was bedridden. And so I really sort of wanted to be near home so I could go back on weekends and things like that. But I really liked the idea of the University of California. So that was where I ended up.
You got an Alumnus of the Year award.
Well, maybe that was after.
You were not the first in your family for that either, were you?
Yeah. No, my father and uncle had both been Alumnus of the Years.
Did your mother's illness have any influence on your research later?
I think it had an influence in the sense that I realized the importance of biological research. I didn't specifically work in that area. And in fact, the area is only becoming more obvious now what to work on. I mean, it was a very mysterious disease at the time my mother got it. I remember, and I was only 10 years old when she got it. And my father, since I was the oldest family, he confided in me about it because, in fact, we had a very good doctor who diagnosed it correctly, but he pretended he didn't diagnose it, you know, because there were a lot of stories in the papers that it was incurable and it got progressively worse. It's really a terrible disease. And my father didn't want my sisters or my mother even to really know it. So he told me because my aunts, who were really loving aunts and things, were very upset that the doctor couldn't diagnose the disease and that my father should go to another doctor. But the doctor had really diagnosed the disease. They just didn't want to tell him because then once they did, every time they read the paper, they'd say to her, well, you know, you're never going to get better. So I knew about it. My sisters didn't know about it shortly after that, too.
But you already kind of knew the basic research
was what I was interested in. And she was always very interested in my doing research. So they were both very good about that.
You have that in common with your wife, Marion, that she had a family member, I believe, who had an illness, and that it sounds like might have gotten her interested
so you,
in immunology.
So it was a little bit, he got typhoid, her brother got typhoid. And so it was a little different because he recovered and got better, but it really influenced her life because, remember, I didn't know her then. That was when she was growing up because I met her in graduate school. But on the other hand, her brother was very ill, and as a result, she was sort of farmed out to some neighboring kids who were very nice about taking care of her because their parents were in the hospital all the time. And then he got out and he'd recovered, but then he had no immune system and essentially got all the childhood diseases. So she was largely raised by her father and the neighbors for many years. And she was very smart and she was way ahead of her class. So that made her, you know, that made her very good at studies.
But his compromised immune system must have been a big factor in her going into immunology.
Correct. Yes.
What were your studies concentrated on when you went into undergrad? Of course, they were kind of basic, but from there?
They were sort of heavily tilted towards enzyme research, which was very chemical. And as a result, but, you know, there's a biological way you do it and a chemical way. And I was oriented towards the chemical aspect of it. See, what happened to me was when I graduated from Cal, World War II started. So I volunteered for the Navy and was promptly rejected because my eyes were terrible. I had 2,400 or something vision, and the Navy guy who examined me told me if they'd let me in, I said, well, you know, at that time it was a different war than the current wars. Everybody wanted to be in. If you were anybody, you just wanted to be in the Army or the Navy. And so I really thought, I knew my eyes weren't so good. But on the other hand, I thought the Navy was saying something about some new thing called radar at the time, and that I knew math and things like that, and I thought I could get in. And they told me that they couldn't let me in because, in fact, my eyes were so bad, the day after I got in, I could sue for a pension and get a lifetime pension for the Navy because I was legally blind. That was their definition. So that was sort of a blow to a young man to be told you're legally blind. But anyway, and I was sort of moping about that, and then I got this offer. Professor Latimer, who was chairman of the department, called me up and said, you know, I want you to go work for Dr. Seaborg, who's in Chicago. And I said, well, I don't know anything about that. And he said, I know what it's about. By then, I had gotten a job as a aircraft, you know, Shell Chemical, making aircraft fuels. And it was what's called a classified job. In other words, in those rules, I couldn't change the job without official bureaucratic approval. So I said I couldn't do it. And he said, no, this can be done. And I knew he was very high up in the circles. And I said, well, what kind of work is it? He said, I can't tell you, but it's the most important work in the world. That's the way he said it. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And I resigned my job at Shell Chemical and went to Chicago, and I didn't know one thing about what I was going to do. I got on the plane, and I got there, and I arrived at Seaborg. I reported, and I said, Dr. Latimer told me to come here. And I said, what am I going to be doing? He says, you're going to build an atomic bomb. That's the first I knew I was going to build an atomic bomb. Then I was on the Manhattan Project for 4 years. So when I went back to graduate school was the end of that period.
I assume you're working on the chemical aspects of
that. Yeah, I was working on the chemistry of plutonium because plutonium was a man-made material. It was made in thing and it had to be separated from all the fission products. It was a really big chemical problem. And, you know, I didn't even realize how difficult it was. But fortunately, Seaborg did, and I was working for him. So he directed his young people. He was very smart. He was very good at directing people, and everybody was very motivated. And, you know, it's a different atmosphere. It's very difficult to recreate that now, and I've said that occasionally, including newspaper reporters, because they always look back on those events as you do now at peace, you know. Well, you know what happened to the atomic bomb and why would you have worked on it and things like that. But there was no moral question then. It was we'd been attacked by the Japanese in the first place and Hitler and so forth had joined them the other way, and this was a weapon that could win the war. And moreover, we thought the Germans were at it. I mean, it was for the, most of the time until the very end, we really thought the Germans were ahead of us. And so we were working, I worked most of the time 6 days a week and many times 7 days a week to get this before the Germans. And most of my colleagues did the same thing. We worked long hours because this was a big thing. So the idea that we would have a weapon that would win the war and we not use it was not, you know, I don't think it was really thought very much.
How long were you working with Seaborg?
I worked in Seaborg's group directly because he became the head of the whole, in the University of Chicago for 42 to 43, maybe about a year and a half. And then I went to Oak Ridge and worked under a guy named Perlman, who was the deputy to Seaborg, who was sent down to Oak Ridge to continue the work we were doing but refine it better, because then we had basically succeeded in what we were going to do, and we just had to get it so it would actually be perfect and put into a bomb.
So the overall time you worked on the Manhattan Project was 2 years?
It was 3 years.
3 years.
3 years.
And you weren't able to discuss this with your family or anything?
I wasn't able to discuss it with my my wife for a while. But then when I married her, she applied for a job. Remember, we in Oak Ridge, there was no... Oak Ridge has basically no... It was a totally synthetic town. I mean, it was just built up... The war was sort of isolated mud flats. And so she wanted a job, and she applied for a job. Her name was Marion Elliott. And we were engaged at the time. And she had become Marion Koshland. So she was women's lib type person. So she didn't want to bank on any, you know, reputation I had. She wanted to see if she could get a job on her own. So she applied to the job as Marion Elliott. And she got a job, and they assigned her to a guy named Koshland. So she ended up, she got a job, and she was told she had to work for Koshland, and her face fell. And the person said, and she realized that if she said no, she might never get another job because there was, you know, very hard to get jobs. And she'd gotten it entirely on her own ability. But then she had to work for me, and that was the tensest time of our marriage. Mm. But we had lots of fun about it. We kidded. But she was a very careful scientist. She was very careful what she did. And I like to draw a conclusion and say, go on to the next step. And my feeling was, if the next step didn't work, then you would find out very quickly if the previous step was bad, because you usually predicted what happened. And then, of course, what would happen is you'd lose twice the time because you'd have to go back and check the other result. But the probability of that happening is very remote, that most of the time you were right the first time, so you go on. And so it made me go a lot faster, and I liked to do that. And she didn't like to do that. She liked to go and check the first step before you went on to the next one. So we had a big philosophical argument. So at work, I would tell her she had to do this. And at home, she'd tell me, Dan, that is really dumb what you asked me to do. I would argue, well, I'm the boss, you know. And then she'd say, do you want dinner or something like that, you know. So we had a lot of fun. But fortunately, the minute we got our degrees, we went in separate labs and things like that.
These differences you had in your approach to science, were they reflected in your personalities on a grander scale, do you think, or the way you approached life?
No. They do oral histories at Berkeley about people and all, and they interviewed my children about Bunny and me, and they said we were terrible because we always agreed about everything. So her approach to raising children and things like that were very similar to mine. So we argued a little about how we did science, but not very much.
And did that help in some ways with your science?
Yeah, it did. It was, as a matter of fact, and we really had a wonderful life because we basically knew enough about each other. I knew enough about immunology to sort of understand what she was doing. I knew why she was doing it and why it was important. But I didn't know enough to really tell her what to do about that. And she felt the same about biochemistry. She sort of knew what was being done, but wasn't a real expert in the field. So we really enjoyed what each other did, and we really understood the other was really the expert in her own domain. That really helped.
Secret to a happy marriage.
It was. Well, it was one secret. It was good, and my children all said, and I felt myself, it's lucky we didn't disagree on how to raise the children, because we both were very strong characters, and it would have been one big fight. but fortunately we didn't.
How did you meet?
We met really socially, totally, not on business. I went to a party, and she was there. She's an attractive blonde young lady. And she said a couple of utterly outrageous things, which infuriated me, but I really noticed her. One of them was, because I sort of pictured myself as a sort of a real athlete, you know, who by mistake had gone into science and things that were academic type, but I was really stood out as an athlete. And she went around the room, I've forgotten, somebody goaded her on, and because she was sort of saying so-and-so is a jock, you know, somebody, and so-and-so's this and that, a Midwesterner or something like that. So she went around the room telling us, she got to me and she said, he's a typical Harvard type. And that really infuriated me. So as a result, I invited her out for a date. And that was his first date, and that was the end of me, you know. We fell in love, and so I got married. But anyway.
I'm afraid to ask, what is a typical Harvard type?
I don't know itself, but anyway, she considered very academic and very argumentative. That was me. She was right.
Fast forward again, back to your being at Oak Ridge together, and then your conversations about science. Do you feel that being married to another scientist influenced your career in any way, or your choices? And
yeah, I think it. I mean, she was very much part of it, but she was very good, and I think I was pretty good about not interfering in the other person's thing. I mean, for example, she had many decisions to make. When I moved to the University of California, which was fairly advanced in our career, they offered me a job, and I just said to them, if she doesn't have a job, I don't move. So they understood that. But she got a job really on her own merits. She got a job, and they offered her a job, a faculty-type job, tenure, and we had five children. Three of those children were in high school or lower schools. Two of the children were in college. And so she said, I can't handle three things. I can do teaching or research and children, or teaching and children. I can do two of three, but I can't do three of three. So I will take a job either in research, and I want to wait till my children are a little older to do teaching and research, which is the traditional academic. So they got her a job, a very good job, with working with Wendell Stanley in the virus lab at Berkeley. And so she did that. And then when the youngest child graduated, she became a professor. Then by then she was really very well known. And the immunology department offered her a job, and she became professor of immunology.
Is this around 1965 or so when this happened? So between the time you were working on the Manhattan Project and then you went back and did more graduate studies?
Or? I went back to graduate school. She went back to she went back to the immunology department, and I went back to the chemistry department, and we both got our PhDs. But we were older than the average person, which almost all my class was. Almost all my class were people who were back, you know, on GI Bill or something, going back to graduate school.
That might have made a difference, a more mature graduate.
It was. All of us were. Everybody was very motivated and things like that, because you were held up. And I thought I was extremely old. I thought I was very impatient to get going and to get on and get a job, because I thought, you know, going to graduate school, I think I was 26 or something like that. That's extremely ancient to be going to graduate school. So I got my degree in 3 years or something, which was pretty fast. And then they told me I should have a postdoc, and I didn't want to have a postdoc. I wanted to just get a job out of it. So then it turned out nobody wanted me, so I got a postdoc.
Where was that?
I got a Harvard, and she got a Harvard, too.
Who were you studying with?
I studied the graduate student I got with Westheimer, and my postdoc was with Bartlett, a guy in the chemistry department. So they were both very big names in chemistry. That was good. And she worked for a guy named Burroughs at the University of Chicago and somebody named Mueller at Harvard Medical School. And he was very nice. He liked her. And all of a sudden, she just was probably good in relation to her name, because, you know, medical schools didn't have a lot of money at that time, at the beginning when she started her career. And so she needed a bunch of cages for guinea pigs. And she asked about doing it. They discussed, you know, what grant and some foundations might have enough money. She needed something like $1,000 or something to make the cages. And all of a sudden, she goes up to the lab she was assigned, and there are those cages. And so she asked the chairman, he said, well, we got those made for you. And she was very pleased. She thanked him, and she started using the cages. Only, you know, it sort of leaked out about a couple of months later. They said, do you know that Howard Miller made those for you himself, by his own hands? This is the chairman of the department. So it was very nice, because he had a wife who was also a scientist, and he knew how much women were discriminated against. So he really liked her and wanted to help her career. But it was really a nice thing to do.
Something you probably don't see that often today.
Nope, you don't. But it was a really nice thing at any age.
Did you see a change in what you were interested in once you came out of working with the Manhattan Project? Did it influence in any way where your research went?
I think not. I mean, I think it helped me in the sense that the research of the Manhattan Project were almost all pure chemistry and physics. I mean, that was really chemistry and physics, because that's what the nature of the work was. So I learned a lot of principles that are useful in all of science, but no biology, really. I didn't have any biological importance. It didn't help me with biology at all. So probably one of the reasons that I went and I got my PhD in chemistry is I felt, you know, if you switch to biology, then you have to have all sorts of courses and genetics and all sorts of things I didn't know anything about, whereas I could get my degree much faster if I just stick with chemistry. And so that's what I did. So I think that influenced me a little bit. And probably, if I had to say, look back on it, I would say, yes, it influenced me, but it was probably my natural bent anyway. So my life has been very unmotivated, I would say. I sort of did whatever was good at the time being and just did the next best thing. I'm sort of a rudderless person, you can guess.
It seems to have a direction, though, definitely.
It ends up in the direction, but that's because of the way the current is flowing, and I'm going along with it.
What particular research areas were you in when you did your postdoc? What areas were you tackling?
So what I was doing with my postdoc, I do remember that, I had gotten out of the Manhattan Project, and so the project I went with Frank Westheimer involved the metabolism of glucose. Glucose, as you know, is an essential sugar. And a new technique had been discovered in the Manhattan Project, namely making radioactive C-14. C-14, you know, is carbon-14, is really very, very useful. I mean, it was something that was made in the Manhattan Project. It was not available before the war. And so people recognized how important it was. So he asked me to make this with radioactive glucose. And so I said, fine, you know, I didn't really realize how difficult that would be. But the only C-14 you could get was barium carbonate from Oak Ridge. You could buy it as a, you know, metallic-type solid. And the way I had to convert it into a compound to make glucose was I put it in a test tube. I put liquid ammonia, a solid potassium. You put them together, and there's a big explosion. And as a fortunate explosion, most of it blew out of the test tube. And at the bottom, there was a little potassium cyanide. And potassium cyanide is a very good thing for making other chemicals. So, you know, there may be a 5% yield in the first experiment, but then I got enough cyanide to make C-14, and I made something called glucose 1-C-14, which is the first that had ever been made. And that was very useful in my research, and so that's what I did.
And you invented this technique to create the component?
Yeah, and I made the thing. And so then I used that in a yeast cell. So it was sort of a biological chemistry experiment. So it derived from my experience with the Manhattan Project, but it really used none of the chemistry I knew before.
Were you publishing these?
Oh, yeah, results? I published that. I published that, and it was a very exciting paper, and it was something called the Notes of the Journal of American Chemical Society, where you could publish very important research in a very short note. And so it was considered quite prestigious to do that. And so we published it there, which was very good for me.
This was the beginning of your publishing?
Yeah. That came up later, because all the work I did on the Manhattan Project was, of course, top secret. So I didn't publish any of that. So at later time, when I was looking for a job, I remember when I first got my postdoc, I was looking for a job. A guy at Columbia interviewed me, And he looked over my list. He says, "You're 31, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "And you haven't published anything?" He says, "People published by the age of 31 never amount to anything. And we are not interested in hiring you." That was it. That's pretty disappointing when you're 31 looking for jobs.
Well, especially since you couldn't publish during that time.
Yeah, well, of course. It was no use alibiing why I hadn't done it, but anyway.
Sort of a catch-22. Was any of that work declassified, though, eventually?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of it was declassified. It's all declassified. But I didn't go back and republish it. It was in scientific sort of records of the Manhattan Project. And Seaborg wrote all sorts of biographies and things like that about a lot of the work.
So this work you did with the glucose 1C14, that was your graduate work?
Yeah. And then I did postdoctoral work with Bartlett at Harvard.
What were you doing then?
There I studied the hydrolysis of acyl phosphates. Those are the very important compounds of energy metabolism in your body. I mean, in fact, it's the way you synthesize almost all the compounds you make. High-energy phosphates is what they're called. And they've just been discovered by Fritz Lippmann, who got the Nobel Prize. And everybody was very interested in them, and I was studying the chemistry of them and the kinetics of the chemical reactions. And so it was pretty exciting work.
Was that your idea, or did someone...
That was my idea, yeah.
And that came somehow from your previous glucose work?
Well, that came because once you finish your graduate work, you have to think from your graduate work what you do next. And there are various people working on phosphate chemistry. And so I was doing the next step, and I didn't want to do what they'd already done. So I did the next step of something that dealt with phosphates, but not what anybody else was doing. So that's what I did. So I had this project, and then I published it.
So it went well?
Went well, and I got invited to go to meetings and give talks about it, and that helped. And so then I eventually got a job.
And that was at Berkeley?
No, I got the first job at Brookhaven. So I went to Brookhaven, and I really didn't want to go to Brookhaven because I really wanted an academic job. And I thought, well, I'll take it for a year or so and, you know, get my feet on the ground and then go someplace else. And I was there 14 years. So that's what I mean about rudderless. I had a very good time there. My wife had a good job. We really both liked it a lot. I think we would have stayed there. And then I got a joint appointment with Rockefeller University. So I was living a very nice life. And then the University of California came along. And then my wife is an Easterner, and she didn't want to move. She really liked it there. And I had gotten a bunch of offers at the time. And, you know, when you're 45, you're sort of movable and so forth. And so I'd gotten these offers from Eastern, and we decided it was just too traumatic. Every time an offer comes in, you have to think about it and telling the people there you're going to leave. And with no more offers. You know, we said, from now on, we won't accept any offers. So I come to my wife and I said, you know, I got a phone call today from Dr. Barker, the University of California. And she said to me, well, you turned him down, didn't you? And I said, well, no. I said, it's sort of rude to do. I said, but I will tomorrow, but it's sort of rude to do it over the phone. So I think I should pretend that I'm considering it. So then the next day I said, well, you know, I better go out. You know, Berkeley is not a place you just turn down like that. I think you ought to go out there and sort of look at it. And she wouldn't go with me. She said, you know, I really don't want to. So anyway, I went out, and then it was awfully good. And so I said, Bunny, I really think you better come out and take a look, which she did. So anyway, as you know, we ended up going there. And she said to me, I knew that first day we were going to move to Berkeley. She says, you've always loved it as an undergrad. I really loved it as an undergraduate. And she said, I knew you would take a job at Berkeley whenever they offered it. And it was basically true. I never even argued about the salary. I never argued about anything except that she had to have a job.
You were originally an Easterner, weren't you?
I went as an undergraduate there, and I had a wonderful time.
But you were born in Manhattan, right?
I was born in Manhattan, yeah. And I always tell everybody that I'm a really good advertisement for the University of California, because when I went there, I couldn't walk, I was bald, I didn't have any teeth. You know, I was 2 years old. And so I said, look at me now. It's California sunshine that did it all.
What was your work at Brookhaven then?
Brookhaven, I was continuing what I was doing. Yeah. But Brookhaven was really good because it was set up by the Manhattan Project to be, you know, the peaceful uses of atomic energy. But it was run by a consortium of Eastern universities. It was had a consortium of Princeton, Harvard, Yale, the major Eastern Ivy League schools, formed a group which then ran Brookhaven National Laboratory. And they ran several other things after. But anyway, that was what they were done for. And so it had an academic atmosphere, but it was an institute. It wasn't a university. And so I could do research, and I had no teaching opposition. And it was really good because I was an organic chemist going into biology, which is unusual. I mean, now it's very conventional, but at that time it was very unusual. So I wasn't really not capable of teaching anything almost. And so it was really good that I could go there and just do research. So it was very helpful to me at that point in my career. And then later on, I got this offer from the university. And it was really not a good job. They offered it to me, but they didn't offer anything to her. And I knew we wouldn't leave under those circumstances, so I just turned it down. But that was a good indication, because if we really felt Brookhaven was terrible, we would have moved there and we would have found out, you know, there was some other school where she could have gone to.
You had a little bit of academic work with Rockefeller, didn't you? Or
was I was a joint appointment. I became a joint appointment between Brookhaven and Rockefeller, so I had two jobs.
Were you teaching or were you just running
the
lab?
Yeah, I taught at Rockefeller, because Rockefeller was a university.
Right. And that got you started in teaching?
Yeah.
Was there a parallel between your work at Brookhaven?
Oh, sure. It was very similar. I mean, I did the same thing at Rockefeller. But Rockefeller really wanted me because I was an organic chemist. And I taught a course in organic chemistry. So that went back to my original training.
Then you made the decision to take this appointment.
So, Brookhaven and Rockefeller was almost ideal for us because I had an appointment in the city. Rockefeller was more prestigious than Brookhaven, although by then Brookhaven was pretty well known. So I didn't need that at that point. But it was very nice, and there were very good faculty there, and I enjoyed it. So that was why we really didn't want to move anyplace. My wife really was against us moving, but I felt Berkeley was really going to be better for both of us, and it was better for both of us.
Brookhaven was a government lab, right?
Yeah, it was a government lab run through the university. And the importance of that is then the people could be hired the way they are at universities without tenure, whereas if you're government, you have to be civil service. The Atomic Energy Commission decided they didn't want to have civil service, particularly for scientific jobs, and therefore they did it by the device of working through this consortium.
And getting into Rockefeller again, I would assume there are less constrictions on the work you did there.
No, Brookhaven was really very good. They let me do anything I wanted. And so Rockefeller, the two were sort of augmented each other, but I ran a separate laboratory. Rockefeller, they really desperately wanted, this is a good situation for jobs. They desperately want you, then they don't give a damn about your qualifications. So they wanted an organic chemist. And so I was already had my job at Brookhaven, so I wasn't really looking for a job. And so I said, well, okay, I'll come in one day a week if you'll give me a lab. That was such an outrageous request. I knew that they would refuse it. Well, they came back to me and said, fine, you got a lab. So I had a big lab at Rockefeller, which I came in for one day a week. It was wonderful. I got a couple of postdocs, and they did a lot of good work there. It was a very nice arrangement.
And when you moved back over to Berkeley, did you take your lab or any of your
stuff? Yeah, all the people.
Everything?
I took, well, when you're a lab, you have a lot of people who are graduate students and postdocs. They usually like to finish up at the same institution, and they all basically finished off. And one or two of them moved out to Berkeley with me, which was actually good for them and good for me. But it was all people who were more at the beginning of their careers, because then they could take three or four extra years at Berkeley. It's really, if you only have a year to go, to move all the way out to Berkeley and then look for a job is really bad. So you always sort of say you're going to Berkeley, and that's a year before you actually move, so you tidy everything up.
So you were doing that for two people.
Well, she did it for her own lab, yeah.
Right, sure. So you're both, I mean, you're both moving.
Yeah, she did the same thing. She brought somebody.
Two labs together.
Something. Yeah, it's a lot of mess, yeah.
It right. took a year or so to reset up, and then you continued with the same research?
Yeah.
The research you've done has been, in some ways, testing some of the accepted, I guess, dogma in your field?
Well, no, I mean, it isn't. What I did is do research. You do research in new areas. And then every once in a while, you run across something which really tests the what was called, you know, the basic laws of some other thing. And so I, early in my career, I did something like that, and then later on, and so I did a couple of things that were very controversial at the time. And those happened both at Brookhaven and again when I moved to Berkeley. So I've had several experiences of doing things like that.
How were they accepted, though?
Well, almost all of them, you know, to get something published in a journal, you've got to have a certain amount of credibility. You've got to sort of do experiments that indicate you're probably right. But people look at it and say, you know, God, I can't find anything wrong with that, but it just seems crazy, right? Well, that's really what it was. And so several of the theories that I had that kind of acceptance. And this is true of even something I published 2 years ago. So, you know, if you do something that really is against the conventional wisdom, but now they're all accepted. So after time, it's the big advantage of being old. Somebody said, you never convince your critics, you just outgrow them.
Well, maybe your credibility has risen also.
Yeah, that's possible. Anyway.
What are the works that you're talking about specifically where you challenge these?
Well, the most famous one, which I'm is called, so-called induced fit theory, which when I proposed it was really quite far out and is now in all the textbooks. The one I published a few years ago was in sort of basically light, the DNL symmetry of light kind of related to it. And that was sort of a controversial thing, but that was published in Nature, and I had a little trouble getting it published, but essentially it was accepted after that. Two or three of my friends told me they didn't believe it, but I think they believe it now. So I published some other theories. I did a theory called orbital steering, which is still not accepted by some people, but accepted by most people, which was considered very controversial. I really remember that I did about 6 or 7 years ago. And I was debating about publishing because I thought, well, I have a pretty good reputation and everybody's going to say I'm talking through my hat. And then I decided, have I gotten so old that I don't want to have any controversies, and decided I better not be so old. So I published it.
How quickly do people start to try to reproduce these works once they're published?
Oh, pretty quickly. And sometimes if they're complicated, it's not that easy to do it right away. So then some things develop more slowly than others. Induced fit, I did experiments that I thought were pretty conclusive when I published it, but a lot of other people hadn't done those experiments. But then gradually, and then all of a sudden, something called X-ray crystallography came in, and then they found it, and then everybody believed it. But that was just the new technology came in, which made it pretty obvious. So some of the other theories came in, and then experimental methods of doing. That's the good thing about theories, is they sometimes suggest experiments that are done, and then you do the experiments, and then it works.
And sometimes you just have to wait for the right technology to...
Correct. Sometimes the technology isn't there. I mean, the famous case, and I don't want to put myself in the same category, but would be Einstein, who predicted that light rays would bend with big gravitational field. You know, the idea is that light rays bend was just incredible. Nobody really thought that would be possible. And then he predicted that, of course, that would mean in an eclipse of the sun, the light rays that went around the sun could be calculated. You'd calculate the star and the rate it was moving, and then you'd see the first light rays that came around the eclipse, and they would look as though they came around in a bent thing because they wouldn't work at a good angle. And it turned out that was tested by a guy, a famous astronomer in England called Eddington, and that was one of the great things that, you know, Einstein made a whole bunch of predictions of that sort, which weren't proven until after his death. So, I mean, sometimes you have to wait a long time for the technology. Sometimes it's done pretty quickly.
I guess string theories like that, too. Someday they'll have
Sure. Same thing. That's very complicated, and moreover, it's very difficult because it's a very general theory. I mean, the relativity theory of Einstein, which was a big argument at the beginning, had in it E equal mc squared, you know, which ended when the bomb went off. I mean, you didn't argue much more about E equal mc squared when you had such a practical application of it. But, you know, you don't have that kind of exhibit very often.
And then I guess you have things like when Einstein threw out some of what he thought, and it's since come back.
Yeah. So some of those are more difficult than others.
How would you compare the work you have done in the government, the private sector, and academia, and then fast forwarding a little, have they all complemented each other, or are there some that you prefer more than others?
I think yes and no. It's a combination. I think one of the advantages of life of being old, you get experience in everything. So everything gives you experience that is helpful in the next step, but they're not linear. It's not obvious there's a relationship. So a lot of the things that I did in one phase of my life sort of led to the next step, and the experience I got in the first step helped the next. But now, in having a job, I remember I was interviewed by National Public Radio, for example, who was very excited about the fact, well, you were in on the Manhattan Project, and you were in on the molecular biology revolution. You know, you've been in on two revolutions. Very few people lived through that. Aren't they very different? Well, in each case, I had a job. You know, my job on the Manhattan Project was to purify plutonium, and I was working with my boss, and it was a really interesting chemistry problem, but it was not, except for the implications, the actual chemistry was not very different from any kind of chemical problem I do. And the molecular biology revolution was really like sort of having a new tool like computers. You know, what does computer do? It didn't really change anything I wanted to do, but it made it a lot easier to do it. So they weren't the kind of things that really changed the job or its satisfaction, but they enormously changed your approach to the job. And I think that's a really important thing, and that was probably something that's important to learn, and that is to think totally differently from what you thought before. And everybody, you know, says things like, think outside the box, as though it's so obvious, but it's not so obvious. And usually somebody comes along and says, you know, you can get rid of three secretaries and have one computer, and you say to yourself, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't really know how to operate a computer. But the facts are you probably can, and that's what happened. And of course, that's part of the problem of employing people now, is that computers have made it so easy, but it's really hard to adjust to that if you really change your lifestyle. So I think going through a big revolution sort of prepares you for the next one. But none of the technology I learned in the Manhattan Project was any use to me in the molecular biology revolution. But just the idea of thinking differently probably was.
Did you feel there was a big difference in the scientific cultures within these different worlds?
A little bit. But for example, my research on the atomic bomb project really was straight chemistry. I mean, it wasn't really that different from any other chemical problem, except, of course, the importance of it was enormous. And the difference of it between, say, my academic work is I was told by my bosses what I was supposed to do. I mean, you were given a lot of freedom within that thing, but my job was to separate plutonium from fission products. And that means I had to purify essentially an unknown element and separate it from other unknown elements. You know, that's pretty scary if you really think about it. You know, separating one unknown from another unknown is, you know, really not easy. But on the other hand, it was a clear job, and that's what we had to do. And you could say, well, you know, I'd rather do something else. In real science, what I do is I pick my own problems, so nobody tells me what to do, but that comes up again and again, because periodically that problem is very difficult, and you say to yourself, you know, that's so difficult, I better pick this easier problem, I better get rid of it. And I think probably the previous experience where I had a very difficult problem and really couldn't do something else because I had to do that, taught me that maybe you don't give up a difficult problem just too quickly. So it probably influenced me more than I think, but there was no obvious sort of chemical procedure that I learned in one that was helpful to the other, because they were totally different.
But in one case, you're working from the end result back, and
right.
Other,
correct.
Kind of striking out with
that's
that,
right.
The rudder.
Well, you were told that you had a goal, yeah. And you weren't allowed to change the goal. So you had to really do it. And in science, when you're academic research, you can change the goal. You know, the student comes back and says it's impossible to do. And you say, you know, I really think, so why don't you try this and this? Well, they say no. And then you argue about how difficult it is. And they say, I got to get my PhD and I got to get out of here. You got to give me a problem I can solve fairly quickly. And so the tendency is to say, all right, I'll give you an easier problem. And I've learned a little bit, you know, I'm not going to be that easy, because sometimes a really tough problem is worth solving and you just got to stick with it.
Do you identify yourself more as an academician, or do you feel
I think that's correct. I mean, I'm clearly an academician. I mean, I spent 1 year in industry, and that's all. And in the Manhattan Project, it's sort of what industry does, in the sense that of having a motivated direct project. And it was a problem that was given to me by my bosses, not by me. But it was academic people on a real frontier. You know, you didn't know what tomorrow brought. Things were changing all the time. So it was much more like an academic world than I would say regular industry is. But it was halfway in between industry and academic.
You spearheaded a huge effort and basically reorganized all of the biological sciences at the University of California,
right.
Berkeley. How did you decide to do this? What seemed to make that necessary, and how did you do it?
Berkeley was, at that point, after it was rated number one, I think maybe with Harvard. It and Harvard were number one in the biochemistry area, for example. But I was observing, and my wife was observing too, because she was a professor of immunology at the time, that we weren't getting as many young and good assistant professors, you know, that when we were competing with Harvard for an assistant professor, they were getting them more of the time than we were, whereas we before were doing much better than they were. So we were slipping. And as far as graduate students, we were slipping. So it was a little bit like we were seeing signs that on the surface, on the top, you know, we had distinguished professors, we were rating very high. So we would discuss this at dinner. This is a good example of discussing it at dinner, because, and her department was in an old building with bad facilities, and my department was in a very new building with a lot of very good facilities. So I wasn't seeing it as badly as she was. She complained about it. So then the guy who was the provost called it one day. We were having cocktails with him, sort of science, sort of social science, you know, having a good time. And he asked about how we were doing. And before I could say a word, my wife said, "We're doing it terribly." And he was, like any good administrator, responding. He says, "Well, you know, we just got number one in the rankings of the graduate study, and we did this and that, and our biochemistry department is doing this and that." And my wife was adamant. And so she simply said, "Yeah, but we're not doing good with the assistant professors and the associate." So Rod turned to me as sort of the arbiter between my wife and him. And I said, you know, I think she's right. You know, she's maybe overstating it a little bit, but she's right that she's seeing the cracks in the wall that are starting to leak. And unless we plug them, deluge is going to come. And we're going to characterize this way. We better do something. So he was not in the power to do it at the time. But shortly after that, he became a vice chancellor where he could really do something. So we appointed a committee to look into it. And it was, you know, changing academia is a real big problem. Professors are very fierce about keeping their tenure and their old things. So he announced he was going to inventory the biological sciences. And he made me and three other people chairmen of various committees to look into this. And we essentially, we called ourselves the Gang of Four. And we sort of took over, and we not only said what the inventory was, but we also said the following things should be done. And as a result, I became chairman of something called the Chancellor's Advisory Committee, which then took over the job of reorganizing the committee. So I was a big force in that. And everybody told me, you know, it's very difficult in an academic world to change a department. So changing a big structure where we changed all sorts of departments was almost impossible. And so essentially we decided that if we're going to change one department, we might as well change a lot. And so we came up with this plan to reorganize biology at Berkeley. And it created an unbelievable fuss. And I give great credit to the vice chancellor, because most big academic things, somebody complains, you know, five professors say this is terrible, that's the end of it. You know, you don't want to do it. And this wasn't five, this was 20 professors in several different departments all saying, this guy Koshlin and their committee have come up with this crazy idea. You got to stop it right now. I remember walking up the campus, and there was somebody by the Campanile, a big building on campus, way up a hill, and he started running down the hill, waving his arms, shouting at me, denouncing me. Turned out to be a good friend of mine who now still is a friend, but he was just furious. So anyway, they really didn't like what was going to happen. Most vice chancellor would have just caved in right at the beginning, and he stuck with us, and we ended up changing everything.
There was some consolidation.
Oh, we wiped out 17 departments. We made 3 new ones.
How did you sell and implement this plan for this massive change?
Every once in a while in science or in the world of politics, you get credit for things you don't deserve, you know. And my feeling is you take them because you get blamed for a lot of things you don't deserve also. So one of the things I did, I was professor of biochemistry, and I was very busy, and my research was going very well, and I didn't want to spend too much time on it. And they always told me that if you're going to do something big like this, you go around to the famous, most prestigious friends on campus, and you talk to them about it, let them in on it, and then they come in favor of you, and then gradually word fills out that this is going to be a good idea. And I didn't have time to do this, and it was long and complicated, so I decided we're just going to write the whole thing up. So we wrote it up, and it was about a 35-page, single-spaced document. You can still get it. And we decided we weren't going to send it to department chairman because we found out a lot of department chairmen who don't like plans like that never circulated to their faculty. So we sent it to all the faculty. Can you imagine what it meant? Some people got this and read, I'm in the professor of zoology. We abolished the zoology department. You know, that was the plan. I'm of course, and we wrote in large letters on this, this is the plan, and it's subject to change. You know, we're going to reconsider it, but we want you to see the overall plan and then write us in, and then we'll adjust to those suggestions that really make sense. So don't consider this a final plan. My friends who were protesting called up and said, Dan, nobody's fooled by that. You know, you don't write 35 single-spaced pages unless it's already done. This is a fait accompli. We've got to go to the chancellor and stop the whole thing or we're never going to get anywhere. And I said, no, you don't. Anyway, and so they really didn't believe that we were willing to change, and we were. And so it gradually went through, and we went through several what we called iterations, which are there were modifications of the plan. So eventually it was finally accepted by everybody, I think. It worked out really quite well. Part of the objection, since I came from a biochemistry department, the zoologists kept saying, you know, Koshlin just wants to impose biochemistry on everybody else. And in fact, molecular biology, I kept explaining to them, was like computers. It doesn't tell you what you work on. It tells you how you work on it. And it's going to be a tool that's going to be as useful to zoology as it is to biology, which is true. I mean, almost all the zoologists in our department are now using it. So it took time to sort of get all that done. And it took, you know, iterations. But it really was a big change, and we did get it through. Something like that had not been done since 1858 when the university was formed. That is how petrified academic institutions can get.
This was in the 80s, and that's also
around
the period of time you became the editor of Science?
Correct. No, and I was on this committee of the chancellor, which, to be very honest, I never would have taken if I knew how much work it was. But what trouble is, it's like a heroin addiction, you know. You get involved, and then you've spent so much time, you feel, well, God, I can't quit now because I'll throw all the time away. So I just each year kept on working, and then it looked like we were really succeeding, so then it looked like it was going to be less work, but it ended up with a lot of work.
How many years altogether was it?
I think it was not really accepted till maybe 90 or something like that, around that time. So you got to have perseverance, and you got to stick with it. And that's one of my generalizations would be about that. You know, there's a phrase, I think Carlyle said it, an institution is the lengthened shadow of one man. It's sort of true. And the part of the reason is that nothing is ever done by somebody having a brilliant idea. It wasn't a brilliant idea to change 17 departments into 3. I didn't write, that sort of came out of it, you know, as you started studying it and went on. So you had to make a whole series of decisions. the same person has to be there to make decision number three, who made decision one, or you lose all the history. So my feeling is some things sort of are really much more efficiently carried through by the people who started it out, as long as they don't stay too long. At a certain point, you're too ossified, you got to get out. But for a while, it's really needed. And if everybody changes every other year, you have no continuity and you lose all the advantage. So anyway, the reorganization really worked. And so that's something I'm really proud of. I mean, that's one of the things that I really look back on my career. Sure. Some of my papers I'm very proud of, but this really worked. And I think everybody really now is pretty happy with it.
Did that work also in your philanthropic work?
As far as philanthropic work, I'm sort of ashamed of that. I consider myself as a scientist. Mm-hmm. And basically, what happened is I had a wonderful father, as I said, who really took care of my financial. I did inherit a little money. And so I really never worried terribly about finances. I mean, in the physical sciences, you get money for graduate school and things like that. And so I didn't have to worry about that very much. So I never really thought very much about how much money I had. So when I got to be 50 or 55 or something like that, I suddenly really had a fair amount of money. And so then I started getting interested in making the money available. My father was a very socially conscious person who felt it was very important to help people who were less privileged than you were. It was sort of an obligation of yours. And so I sort of neglected that part of my life. And then I really started to do it, and I still do it. And I would say the answer to it is, the way I do it is I don't have any staff for things doing that. I just basically give the things I know about. So things like the National Academy, the University of California, a college that my kids went to, namely Haverford, I've given some things to. And I give them small amounts to things like the Community Chest and Redwood Cross and things like that, which I think are very good organizations. But I don't have a staff that can give out big amounts. So I would rather give big amounts of money to people I think are running things well.
I want to move back to ask you about your editorship at Science. There you also dealt with some controversy.
Yeah. Well, editorship of Science came on me totally unexpected. Did I tell you my absolute perfect syllogism that I got? I gave an undergrad course at Cal, which involved philosophy of happiness. And I looked up in all these Spinoza and Kant and famous philosophers what definition of happiness, and none of them are very good. The best one I found was one that said, success is getting what you want. Happiness is wanting what you get. I think that's perfect. Anyway, that's my situation. So what happened to me is I was just going along, and at the end, sort of, the reorganization was sort of in a downhill slope. We knew it was going to work, and it was just a matter of cleaning up the details. So I was looking forward to getting back to my research and doing things like that, and I get a phone call from David Hamburg, it turned out, who's the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which owns Science Magazine. Would I be the editor of Science? And so I said, well, I hadn't thought about it, but what did it involve? And he said, well, it's a full-time job and you move to Washington. I said, well, I'm not interested. I said, because I really don't want to disband my lab and I'm doing research and so forth, so forget about me. I said, if I could do it half-time, I might be interested. I just sort of said that as a casual end of the thing and hung up, and that was it. And I didn't think about it again. And 3 months later, David Hamburg calls me up and says, Dan, you know, I've been talking to the board, and they said, you know, if you do it halftime, we'd be glad to consider it. So then I went out to my patio where my children were, and I said the conversation and said, well, you know, I turned it down, and I said, well, he said, what do you mean? Why didn't you even want to consider halftime? I said, well, you know, I got this project at Berkeley that's finishing up. I got this and that. I got my research. And so my daughter-in-law, and I told her, I think I better finish up these things at Berkeley. And so she said to me, oh, you'd prefer to be provincial than global, is that right? So I was just so mad at this pipsqueak telling me I was provincial, you know. I thought it over again, and I said, well, maybe I ought to do it. So I called him up, and that's what I ended up doing. So I went back there, and I said to appraise it then, could I do it halftime? They had never had a halftime editor. They said they were willing to try it. And I said to them, well, I don't want any contract. I said, all you have to do is any day you tell me that I'm not doing well, I'll just go back to being a professor. I mean, I have another job. It isn't as though you're firing me. And I will tell you if I don't think it's going well, and I'll tell you to look for a successor. I'll give you some notice. So that's what we did. That was the arrangement, and I just had a handshake, and it was really nice, and it worked out very well. So when I quit, then at 10 years, I decided I had enough, and I gave them a year's notice. They hired somebody else at halftime because they thought it worked so well.
Was that an eye-opening experience, though, to be able to see kind of the whole of the scientific world, what's going on, and
yeah, it was,
what worked?
Well, I had been editor of sort of specialized journals, mm-hmm. like the Journal of Biology, but not the editor. I had been the editor of the Proceedings of the National Academy. So I had some experience with being a little bit
global.
Editor, but it's nothing near like science. It's a big circulation, big advertising. So it was a new experience, and you sort of learn on the job. I mean, it's one of the things you have to do. All the good people I know learn as they get the job, because the job is totally new and something they have to learn while they're doing. Anyway, it was a good experience. And I think, you see, the previous experiences I had in the reorganization and everything all helped. But it was different. It's different.
You got to do a little humor bit, too?
Well, the humor bit, they didn't like at the beginning. The first editorial I remember I wrote, they came back and said, you know, we're not a humor magazine. This is a serious magazine, and it really is bad for scholarship that you write these funny jokes and things like that. And so I said, well, you know, you better talk to the bosses, because I really can't write things without some humor in them. And that was it.
That shows a little bit of your step a little more towards science within society, not just science as an enclosed society itself. I mean,
correct.
That's one of your big concerns.
No, and that's and it's also what I like to occasionally tell students about that is that you never know. I had all my life when family gatherings. We have a big family, and there are all sorts of things where I have to write skits, you know. And my family is such that Auntie Maggie doesn't have a birthday on her 50th or 60th or 70th. She has a birthday on her 50th or 51st or 52nd. Now, we don't make an equal big fuss about it, but I have to write a lot of poems, and I have a lot of aunts. So I had gotten so used to writing poems on the last minute. Usually when my wife was driving over to San Francisco, I'd write a poem for the event that I had to read that night at dinner. So the idea of writing an editorial in the last minute didn't terrify me at all. But people after always used to say, Dan, I don't see how you write all those editorials. The editorial was the least amount of work that I did at All Science Magazine. I really worked for a lot of it. My editorials I really enjoyed.
Obviously, you're very concerned with science and society. The museum that will be opening in April, which is the Marianne E. Koshland Science Museum,
yeah.
which is at the National Academy of Sciences building. Was the idea for the museum born in some way out of the work you were doing?
No. I think the idea, what happened was my wife died. I was really very devoted to her. We had a great marriage. We had wonderful. We were 50 years together, and then she died of cancer, for lung cancer. And I was bereft. I really felt it was sort of the end of the world. And I really felt, I guess, the way almost everybody does, it was really so unfair, not what was treated to me, but that her life was such a great life that it shouldn't just disappear. You know, something should go on. And so I thought of the various things she'd been involved in. She'd been involved in a number of things. But the Academy was one special thing. She was on committees of the Academy. She'd been very active in them. She'd always loved students and helped young scientists and things like that. So I came to Bruce, and Bruce had put her on several committees, totally independent of me. So I said, I'd like to do something for her. Is there something the Academy could do? And he came back to me after about a day or so, and he said, well, there are a couple of things. And he knew she was interested in the public understanding of science. That was one of the things she was active in. So he said, one of these is a fund for the Committee on the Public Understanding of Science, which would be a certain amount of money. And he was sort of vague. Almost any amount you want would be good. Or we could do a museum. We've been thinking of doing a museum, which would cost more. So I remember thinking it over not very long, because I felt I really wanted to do something significant for her. So I chose the museum. And I think both Bruce and I had a vague idea of what a museum, and we wanted a museum that would be the public understanding of science, and neither of us had any idea of the complexity of it. It turns out to be much more complicated than we thought. And I remember one of the questions you sent me at the beginning was whether or not it was like what we had planned at the beginning. And the answer is, the idea that's the public understanding of science and a little bit of really explaining science to the public, still there. The construction of it and how you do it and the details of what's in it is totally different from anything we were thinking about. I mean, it has some of the basic ideas, but we really weren't thinking in real terms. I mean, we never knew anything about designers or anything like that. And so what Bruce and I did after that, when we sort of decided to do it, we both got in the business of learning about museums. And I'd go to museums and I'd be very proud and I'd say to them, I've been to the Natural History Museum in New York, because, you know, I was invited to give a talk in New York. And so I went to the History Museum, then I went to the ones in Berkeley, and I went to one in Chicago. And Bruce always outdid me. You know, he says, well, I just came back from the one in Beijing, you know, and something like that, and London. And so, you know, he couldn't possibly be competed with anyway. So we came back with all these ideas. But then we gradually got an idea of how we ought to do it. And so then it's formed down to really the structure we got now.
Is there a basic mission?
Yeah, I think some of the early designers that I had to see had wonderful things. You know, you pressed them and all sorts of lights went on. It was sort of like playing the slot machines. But you didn't understand anything out of it. So the net result was you were sort of impressed by science, but you really didn't learn anything. And we decided that we really wanted people to learn a little about how science is done. Then, of course, we came across the really important thing is that to learn something, you got to have some text and you got to have some lectures and things like that. And then it would just be a lecture and everybody will be bored to tears. And I wanted to have something that would really be attractive to a layman. In other words, a museum that people could go through in a short period of time and get a lot of the excitement of science. And if they felt like they didn't want to say that much, they could just leave. It would be not a tremendous museum, a small one, but you could go spend half an hour or three quarters, and I'll really learn a little about science. And if they go home with one really astonishing fact that tells them a little about science, we've succeeded. And then I think the purpose of the museum now is quite clear. We're going to have exciting new things, and we're going to have a website for the people who want to do more, because we can't possibly in this small museum have all the things that are possible in the world. So it's much smaller than the Smithsonian, but on the other hand, I think it will be a little gem. I think people will really like it.
And with the web, it'll be
much
larger.
With the web, you can expand on it and so forth. And so, for example, we'll have the DNA, and the DNA is going to bring up all sorts of questions about things which will make people want to learn more, but they can't possibly learn it all in the museum.
Will it reflect some of Marion's concerns or interests in science, like women in science in any way?
I think it fulfills what I think would be her spirit. But remember, this was all, the whole idea of a museum never occurred till after she died. But she was very interested in young people. She was interested in the public understanding about science. She was interested in women in science. And I think the fact that the institute is named in her name, museum is named as a woman scientist, is really good. In the sense, I think it's good for women scientists in general.
Or aspiring women scientists?
Correct.
I guess your hopes for the museum would be that you would have lay public, lay press, and scientists?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody?
Everybody. We're aiming it for the typical Washington visitor and the kind of person that will go to the Lincoln Memorial, and we would like to come to the Science Museum.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.